possibility today? We just have 30 seconds.
That's a good question. What we've been thinking is that the United States needs to come up with plans for what to do after we go into war. The United States likes to plan wars a bit, but the after effects, the aftermath, planning what to do with all the stuff that's left behind seems to be not considered much.
Well, Jerry Redfern and Karen Coates want to thank you for being with us, co-authors of Eternal Harvest, The Legacy of American Bombs in Laos. And thanks so much to New Mexico PBS. That does it for our show. We have two job openings. Democracy Now! Is hiring administrative director and a Linux systems administrator, as well as fall internships. Visit democracynow.org/jobs for more information. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Aaron Mate, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Rabbi Karen, Dina Geisler, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Tarina Nadura, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, as well as Julie Crosby, Becca Staley, Hugh Grant. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Paul Rowland. Today's guest is journalist and social political analyst, Norman Pollack. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
I'm Monica Beamer.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. We're KBOO's new co-station managers. We're excited to be a part of the KBOO community. We're starting a new weekly feature on Wednesdays at 5:45 p.m. News from the Boo will give you an inside look into what's happening at KBOO, including upcoming events, station news, special programming, and future goals and plans for the station.
Be sure to tune in this Wednesday and every Wednesday after the KBOO Evening News for News from the Boo, an insider look into your community radio station.
Tune in Saturday, June 28th for a live broadcast from Good in the Hood. KBOO will broadcast the entertainment from Lilith's Albina Park from 2 to 7 p.m. Tune in to hear what's good in the hood Saturday, June 28th from 2 to 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. And we start out a little bit late with Consolidated's Friendly Fascism. Missed the first couple seconds of that, but I think you got the point. That goes back to the mid-90s, I think. Friendly fascism, that's what we're going to be talking about today. I provocatively titled this program, Are We Living in a Corporatist Fascist Society? If so, what then? And to help us talk about that, we have Norman Pollock, who has written several books and currently writes a lot on the Counterpunch website, www.counterpunch. And he's with us by phone. Hello.
Hi, Paul. In response to the question, I've got my right hand reaching toward the ceiling, but because of a torn rotator cuff, I can't quite get up there, but... Yes, I in the affirmative. I think we're getting there.
Right hand reaching to the sea. Is that a la Dr. Strangelove? Is that what you're...
I've been using Strangelovian imagery in some of the pieces because, Terry Southern really should be writing the script for the National Security Advisors. We're getting close. Paul, let me just very quickly say that I looked at the website this morning, and I very much liked what I saw. How KBOO came into being, its manifesto, and I think that Oregon is lucky to have a voice that's so responsive to the needs of the community, not watered down in content, and not afraid of airing controversial views and subjects. So I am really delighted to be one of your guests.
Well, thank you for that. And I forgot to ask you, so exactly where are we reaching you?
Oh, East Lansing, Michigan. It's called Flyover Country. And about the only way I feel I'm getting any feedback or contact is from either coast. Certainly not in East Lansing.
Well, hopefully we'll...
but it's okay.
Yeah. I'm sure, maybe things are good. Maybe, you don't have a community station there, I take it.
No, we have an FM college PBS station. My feelings about PBS is that it seems to be cozying up so much to government, that the national government, that I kind of dropped away from that. Plus, they had at one point very fine classical music, and that programming has now become standardized from some other outlet. And so, no, there isn't anything like you guys or WBAI in New York, or I remember as a kid, KPFA when I was at Stanford for a short time.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys, with whatever it is, listener subscription, non-commercial, you've got my vote.
Well, and we seem to have the vote of quite a few of our listeners. And if you listeners have not voted in favor of supporting us financially as well as by listening to us, you can always do that by going to kboo.fm. We always like to put that little reminder out. So let's talk about this subject. So, when people use the word fascism or fascist, people might think of like mass political rallies, strongman leaders like Mussolini or Franco, or people like Hitler, who was kind of a hypnotic orator and a master manipulator of propaganda techniques and the mass media. They might think of, jackbooted thugs beating up political opponents on the streets, to quell any opposition, concentration camps. And, we don't seem to have those things specifically in the United States. So, you've had this series of articles. I've got three here in front of me. The most recent was Reflections on Fascism, Corporatism, and American Birthright. That was just published in the last weekend's edition of Counterpunch. Then you had Edward Snowden and the Exposure of Voyeuristic Fascism, the subhead Self-Pacification of the American Citizenry. That was June 28th of last year. And then Liberal Fascism in America, the Obama Era, just after the inauguration. So you've been, dwelling on this theme quite a bit recently, and you've had several others. So just go into it. First, I guess we need to really talk about what is fascism.
Okay. Now, Paul, we can do one of two things. I can start with just something I jotted down a few minutes ago, because basically I try when I write to sit down, I guess a lot of people do this, and just really focus as intensively as I can on something highly specific, and then let it go from there. You suggested in the email that I might want that it would be okay to read those first two paragraphs from that Reflections on Fascism, which really kind of do it. But first, just in a general way, let me kind of say this, because you touched on it with your own words. And I see fascism as a structural formation with or without the concentration camp. Sure, the overt Nazi and Italian and Falange, Franco fascism with concentration camps, an obvious element. But if one were to move up in a kind of broader direction, I think that as a start, one would see an element or infusion of racism. And by racism, last night, some of you may have seen on in the audience the PBS on the Freedom Riders, and how Freedom Riders in one Greyhound bus were mobbed and prevented from moving forward and then set on fire and only somehow escaped alive. And the ferocity, and I've witnessed this myself in Mississippi, and I've witnessed this at other times doing research in the South, and just being a stranger, that kind of thing. And racism itself, should it also take on a more generic character, what we were calling, say, around 1950 with the authoritarian personality studies, the idea of ethnocentrism, the we-they dichotomy. And in a way, that we versus they dichotomy, a functional type of that under Nazism and elsewhere was of course anti-Semitism. And so this search for the generic victim, and that to testify to one's own moral ideological superiority of the in-group. So that in-group is that core striking out, but then going a little further, just even on that end of things, I think in fascism you see the exaltation of the nation, and that might not be as central as it simply logically follows from the self-image of glory and militarism going hand in hand with this thing that to me is really fascism, and that is a structural proposition here, the internal hierarchical structure and value system. When one speaks of hierarchy, one speaks of everything, class structure, prevailing dominant values, and just the actual domination itself that is built into the structure and translated downwards, so that what one sees in fascism would be an elite at the top and, say, via propaganda, making the masses feel attached to that leadership, sharing in the virtues of the nation, or, let's say, of the state with a capital S. And one of the things that just, as I'm saying this, that comes to mind is we're saturated with the idea of patriotism. And patriotism seems more and more to be coded with that kind of submission to authority, that coded with allegiance to the state, with war, intervention, regime change, the whole business. And to dissent from that is now to stand out, and stand out maybe in a more subtle way, so that we don't even notice it anymore, which is even more insidious. But very much like, I think I might have written about this at some point, very much like a recapitulation of McCarthyism, that we're really back in the 1950s in that sense where counterterrorism is now that key word or term that used to be anti-communism. They're basically the same in the sense of the way the authority structure has used either to bring about social control of the population. So that would be it, Paul, as a start. I mean, really, it's a way of saying that you cannot have a democratic society and have the kind of massive surveillance of our own people that is occurring in this society. And that is the contradiction or a contradiction. And because I like to work, maybe wrongly, but as my kind of historian, working from the highly specific to the general, it seems to me that presidentially authorized drone assassination is incompatible with democracy. And so if you can have drone assassination coming from the White House with that little group of national advisors sitting off the Situation Room, pouring over their hit lists, et cetera, and ordering the assassination of people, no trial, no obviously anything, and leaving in its place a vaporized human being. Those who have studied this have described it. You leave in its place a blood spat. And that, to me, is where we're at. And just to have that, just to have even a single example, a highly concrete example, is itself a way of revealing the underlying structure of society.
Well, you know, it seems like, you know, when you say, maybe one reason there's a resistance to thinking that we're, say, in a fascist state, people, you know, obviously want to, you know, don't want to give up hope or think that they're fighting something other than a democratic system in which you can, you know, elect new leaders to change the system. It seems like a fundamentally different beast, you know, a more authoritarian type of structure of power rather than what we think we live in, which is a constitutional system. But so you know, did it mutate into something different? Was it always that way? I mean, because the way you fight against it, really, it really makes a difference what you call it, I guess. I mean, that's what I take out of this discussion. Why bother talking about fascism? What does it matter what you call the system?
Right, Paul, that's very good. I'm serious. That's the kind of thing it's a kind of annoying thing, annoying GNAW, if my pronunciation isn't that good. It's a very important thing. To say what I said does not, certainly not from my end, does not advocate for submission or giving up or heart or losing heart or anything else. I'm not versed in existentialist thought, but this whole idea of if you even can utter or think a free thought, that in itself is a liberating experience, is emancipation. That isn't good enough, because if the context is oppressive or repressive, then you're kidding yourself. So basically, I think all I'm trying to say here is, if I'm anywhere in the ballpark, that is to say, if there's any kind of an accuracy to the general description, then that should never be used as one's own excuse for letting down, for letting go. And as to what you were saying, I think there has been, if you can say it this way, there has been an incremental progression of repression, I think, in our history. And at some point, and I don't know if this is the way a Marxist would view it, but at some point you move from a quantitative to a qualitative stage. That is to say, something new, a new formation, something different. But if one looks at even the industrial history of the United States, beginning with the Great Railroad Strikes of 1877, and you see the degree of suppression of labor protest going all the way through. And if you then see things like, and these are only highlights, but things like the Palmer Raids at the time of the ending of World War One, and so on. I can give you one quick example that hit home to me. when I did my, I passed my generals, which were the doctoral exams at Harvard, and I had a very bright undergraduate who brought to our apartment for a little celebration Isaac Deutscher, who was a truly great historian. And he sat down with me, and he was in Cambridge because he was working on the Trotsky papers at the Houghton Library. And he said to me, you know, and he had been in the same library going over other papers, say, at the height of McCarthyism, which would have been maybe 8 or 9 years before. And he said to me, you know, things seem so much more pleasant now, but if anything, they're worse. And they're worse because what has happened is that we have internalized that restraint. We have accepted the boundaries. The boundaries are narrowing ever more, and we don't even feel the pain anymore. And this is said in 1959. And I don't think there's much since that time to have altered the situation. And if anything, this is where liberalism sort of becomes the helpmate of corporatism, where liberalism puts, I don't know how I said it, but sort of like gussies up the image, it cosmetics, makes the authoritarianism somehow acceptable and palatable. So now you have people surrounding Obama who speak, in effect, of what is being called liberal humanitarianism. And liberal humanitarianism is just another public relations phrase for intervention and for the imposition of American control over whatever the object of the intervention is. So I really think it's a fairly advanced stage, and I think that as we started, and as you mentioned, it doesn't necessarily require the concentration camp, especially if people handcuff themselves. And
of course, we have mass incarceration, and there are arguments to be made that those are a form of concentration camp.
And that's very good. And you see, that's where I'm so darn narrow. I'm aware of these things, but there's so many areas I haven't gotten into, and I've mentioned that. And and if one were to really try to disentangle that, among other things, obviously, it's a, what would the word be? Not regurgitation, but let's say the revitalization of racism, judging from the prison population. And what it can very well be is simply a signal or a very heavy-handed form of intimidation to the entire black community to know your place, something like that. I don't know, since I just haven't. But you're right. I haven't seen the statistics, but I'm sure America has incarcerated in proportion and in sheer volume more than all other industrial nations, perhaps even combined. And when you get this incarceration, although we haven't talked about this, the walls get a little thin because, okay, right now, blacks, next, perhaps white dissidents. Certainly what we saw this past week, journalists, in this case in Egypt, but with Kerry right there the day before the announcement of the court, jumping into bed with this dictator, Sisi. So that we're countenancing or legitimating all kinds of what I'm using the word, it maybe doesn't seem to fit these days, but I'm using the word counter-revolution. We seem to be sort of putting our shoulder up against all kinds of democratization.
Melissa, I'd like to break in just for a second. This is a talk show, so we'd like to invite callers to call in.
You're right. Of course, Paul. Go ahead.
And the number is 503-231-8187 to call in, to join in with Norman Pollock, who's joining us from East Lansing, Michigan. And we're talking about, is the United States a fascist country? And what does that mean? And what does that imply for our response to it? I mean, if the normal remedies that we think of in terms of, you know, electing new legislators to make changes, new president, are those actually effective, or maybe not just are they effective, but are they effective by themselves. Is there, what forms of resistance are possible? What forms of resistance are necessary if this scenario, which is very difficult to pin down, because, you know, what you're saying is this is a very different form if this is a form of fascism. And you point out saying that hierarchical societal framework characterized by extremes of wealth and power, a system of government authority, its opaqueness shielding it from accountability in both domestic and foreign policy, and because of its secrecy, able to hide its disconnection from the public interest. And you go on, there's various other characteristics. But its very opaqueness, kind of slipperiness, really, makes it really difficult to pin down. But so that it's almost more difficult than a very obvious strong-arm dictator like Mussolini, you know, or Franco or Hitler, who just go out and beat up or kill their political opponents. Then the lines are so clearly drawn that, you know, at that point, you know, armed resistance becomes the only option. So we're in this sort of strange gray area that I think we really need to think seriously about what that gray area really is.
That is so well stated, Paul. I can't improve. So let's hear what some of the guys out there have to say.
Or gals, case may be.
Of course. Yeah, when I say guys, I mean both. I hope no one is offended by that. It's just my...
No, it's all good.
I'm still a creature of the 1950s. Sorry. But it's okay. Gals especially. Go for it here.
Well, actually, we have Boris on the line. Hello?
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to ask your guest if he's familiar with a book by the very appropriate title of Friendly Fascism, written back in 1980 by an author named Bertram Gross.
Boris, I saw that on the website this morning, and I have not read it. And I'm giving away, if anybody, you know, is listening for some really important titles, if I may just quickly say three titles, because it's almost as though the whole academic world, and not 1980 quite yet, and thank goodness that book, and I hope I will read it soon, but that whole, there's been a real shift where it's as though the intellectual horizons have dropped off after somewhere around that point, and we are unaware of the very important work. Franz Neumann's Behemoth is probably the key book on Nazism. And there are two books in America. All these, Neumann, I think, was around 42, and two books around 38 to 40. Robert A. Brady, a Columbia economist, wrote a book called The Spirit and Structure of German Fascism, in which he, among other things, had side-by-side columns using specific official Nazi front organization statements, and in parallel columns, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the NAM, and they matched. One cannot get away from the importance, and we didn't get a chance with Paul to get into this yet, but the business structure itself is really at the essence, or if one wants, the advanced stage of capitalism, I don't care, but is at the essence of that hierarchical framework. And so that and Brady's Business as a System of Power. And these are books, again, by 1940, but looking at speaking of Germany and at the same time, it would take a real lunkhead not to recognize similarities with American organizational structure and practice.
Well, maybe, Boris, so, you could tell us a little bit about that book then.
Well, I think this book might be even more important than the ones that your guest mentioned, in that back in 1980, Mr. Gross was laying out exactly where this country was headed, and it, in a very prescient way, described exactly what we have in this country. And the reason that I say it's important is because he points out that the fascists that we are dealing with now are so cleaned up and sanitized and so polished and neatly put together they're wearing three-piece suits, and they're not wearing jack boots. So the people who I encountered back in the day, back when things were going hot and heavy in the streets of Portland, in fact, I was arrested protesting fascism right here in Oregon. The people of that day, you know, a lot of the people that I talked to and tried to tell them about this book and about what I saw, you know, myself, would basically retreat into denial because they didn't see jackbooted thugs in the streets. They had a very difficult time recognizing fascism dressed in a three-piece suit. So I think that the book Friendly Fascism is incredibly important for really emphasizing that point.
Okay, well, thanks for bringing that up. So we've got a few resources here for readers, for listeners to delve into. Franz Neumann's Behemoth, Robert Brady, The Spirit and Structure of German Fascism and Business as a System of Power, and Bertram Gross's Friendly Fascism. Yeah, I remember when that came out, too. I actually didn't read the whole thing, but I kind of got the idea. So I think friendly fascism, liberal fascism, they're fairly similar concepts. And let's go to another caller. LJ, you're on the air.
Well, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Pretty good. Yourself?
Great. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you so much for the dialogue. Just a couple of points. As far as drone attacks and terrorists are concerned, the Obama administration has legally justified the fact that they can actually kill American citizens using drones. They have killed two American citizens, Abdul Rahman, who was a 16-year-old boy, and they also killed his dad using drone attack, and it's perfectly legal and perfectly justified. Ron Wyden is the only one who seems to be bringing up the fact that this is an illegal, unconstitutional act.
So what does this have to do with fascism?
I'm sorry?
So I'm trying to keep us to the point of, you know, fascism in the United States.
Yeah. And the next point is, Paul, that recently there's been attacks on a Sikh temple I don't remember where several people were killed, and then there was a recent attacks on a Jewish community center and a Jewish old age home where a couple of people were killed, and this act of terrorism was committed by a white supremacist Nazi sympathizer. And the media seems to refuse to call these people terrorists, whereas if a Muslim would commit the same heinous act, they would automatically be labeled as a terrorist. And I want to know why the media does not call these right-wing nuts terrorists when they commit terrorist acts, and on the other hand, why they jump at the fact of calling Muslim terrorists. And I certainly will take my answers off the air.
Okay. Norman?
Second.
First off, I forgot my provinciality that Ron Wyden is one of yours, which is wonderful.
Right.
And that's good. Okay. Now, the only thing I can say to the caller is that, I'm not sure if I can say it this way, but that not only is there a double standard operating here, and that double standard which protects the right wing in general and makes this distinction and so on, but it would seem to me, even with that first example of the drone assassinations, that the real terrorism is our own.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Pogo's, we've met the enemy and it's us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the very fact that the causes of the tension that your examples show, that they are never addressed, that they're never addressed in the sense of whether we're speaking of things like gun control or the degree to which there is impoverishment in the country and the growing formation of an underclass, et cetera, et cetera. The way we legitimize selective instances of violence and then heap on to the others is a sign of how deeply contradictory our own system of values and power is. I know that's too vague an answer, but all I can do is agree with you that it's a selective whatever name calling going on, and that a lot of what is real violence, and if I can just, there's one really great writer who is probably not read anymore, Barrington Moore, and Moore spoke about legitimated violence. And legitimated violence, the real violence, is when you see people who have been foreclosed and forced into the street, when you see increasing poverty going on because of the way the system operates. But that's not called that. And I guess my larger point, if I step back, and I might be way wrong on this, is there probably would not be this violence in the world in terms of what are presumably Muslim terrorists and so on, if we did not have the kind of active foreign policy from 1945 on, which saw us ring the entire globe with military bases, including in Saudi Arabia, which got bin Laden, obviously, off on what he was doing. There are people, you know, they're much brighter than I am, who come up with things like Chalmers Johnson was talking about blowback. Mm-hmm. You can't run a world repressive machinery and not expect something to come back, whether it's from outside or the poison that you've instilled into your own people because you've accustomed them to violence, you've accustomed them to hate, and you've also created an educational system which doesn't in any way comport with the kind of tolerance and love of humanity that would recognize the immorality of the acts that are being committed.
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling, LJ.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for the show, Paul.
Okay, I'd like to remind listeners that you're listening to KBOO Community Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio, and I'm speaking with Norman Pollock, who's written a number of articles for Counterpunch magazine, web magazine, about fascism in America, kind of a taboo subject. So why do we talk about fascism? What does fascism mean? Why is it important to label the United States fascist if it is? One thing we haven't really talked about is, you know, this whole idea of corporatism and basically what you're laying out. You know, obviously so many things have happened. The Depression happened. You know, there was a resurgence of labor militancy in the early part of the 20th century. The 1960s happened. But all through that, you know, there's certainly been a huge increase in civil liberties, a whole incorporation in giving voting rights to whole sectors of the population, giving housing and employment rights, increased rights. So, you know, those are undeniable. But through the continuity, through that of the accumulating power of corporate control, which is basically the main hallmark you're talking about of fascism, basically, and the increasing blending through subsidies, through the revolving door of oversight agencies and business, this really strong nexus between corporate and government power in this country. That's basically the hallmark of fascism that you're talking about, I believe. But before you answer that, let me get one of our callers will ask a question and it can dovetail because we have a couple callers. Steve, who's our next caller? Ben, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. There was a study done recently. You probably know of it more than I, but it was done about from 1979, and they were saying essentially that political policy in America has essentially been dictated by corporations, and they can pretty much lay that out and look at it. Okay, so now, in my mind, consumerism is the opiate of the masses. So we've been anesthetized to submit to whatever is going on, and we are too desperate to pay our bills, to pay our mortgage, blah, 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 to gain material wealth, so that, you know, we are become apathetic, so we're not going to do anything. Okay, so then you have McCutcheon and you have, Citizens United. Those essentially open the door for corporate, to take over for corporate imperative. And we could go on and on about it, obviously, but that pretty much spells it out. That pretty much opened the door or slammed the door for a democracy. I think voting is an illusion, and it's just simply window dressing, and pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Let's give Norman a chance to respond to that and my previous comment. Go ahead.
Okay. Ben, I don't think I can say it any better. But my problem there is, and it seems to be all of our problems, is where does one go from there? That is, when you use the phrase corporate imperative, that was very good. And what I didn't start with, which, again, I kind of noted down that I wanted to mention, is a word that sounds a little bit, maybe it sounds a little hard to swallow, but the word is interpenetration. Interpenetration meaning that what we see here are the parallel structures of business and government, and they are each interpenetrating the other. And I think you've described that, and Paul has on this. But it becomes almost like a synthesis, a kind of integrated structure. And that integrated structure, for me, not only kind of beckons fascism, but really is the nature of an advanced industrial capitalist state or society, where it's never just the economy. It's always government doing things, whether it's expanding the military power of the state in order to gain foreign markets and financial advantages, or as happened in this country, and here the really wonderfully important work. A dear friend of mine who passed away within the last 2 weeks, Gabriel Kalko. And Gaby wrote the book Triumph of Conservatism. And this deals with the whole basis of, he uses the term interpenetration as such, but that whole basis of how government and business have become so tightly woven together, with government essentially working to pave the way for monopolization and further consolidation, so that the entire regulatory process is really a process that is business defined, is not meant to regulate, never was meant. And Gaby brings out not only the ICC in another book, Railroads and Regulation, from the earlier period, but Theodore Roosevelt's Bureau of Corporations, and then, of course, Woodrow Wilson's Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve System does not regulate banking. The Federal Reserve System is banking, essentially, in its most intensified form. So it's a farce. I don't know if you used farce, but I'll use farce. And that's what liberalism is. Liberalism uses this idea of the regulatory society and voting and all the rest as though they were substantively valid, when in fact they really have become, and maybe from its inception, the whole trend has become more of a formalistic thing in order to fend off real criticism and real protest.
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling, Ben. We do have a couple more callers, but first I'd like to remind listeners that coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives, this economic update, host Richard Wolff discusses a new book, Unbalanced, The Codependency of America and China by Stephen Roach. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15 on Flashpoints, an in-depth look at Egypt under its new president, also violations of international law regarding U.S. war policies in Iraq, and a report on the 2010 drone memo released this week by the Obama Justice Department.
Wow.
And 11 on the Recovery Zone, author Stephen Herod Buhner discusses plant intelligence in the imaginal realm. And thanks once again for listening to KBOO Radio. Thanks for to KBOO members for your great support for the station. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. You are listening to Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland, and I'm speaking with Norman Pollack from Michigan, who's written a number of books and is currently mainly writing for Counterpunch magazine. And he's written several articles on fascism in America, which is what we're talking about today. So let's go to our next caller. Heidi, you're on the air.
Hey, I am just thrilled that Norman... Hi, Norman. I'm so happy that you're on Democracy Now! Or not Democracy Now! That's funny. KBOO.
Hi, Heidi.
That's a compliment to you, but actually, I want to say I regularly go to Counterpunch. They're some of the best journalism that's happening, and especially your pieces, because I believe that you talk unequivocally about the state of fascism and what really is. It's like the United States doesn't like to think of itself that way, but you look at the specific behaviors by the state, and that's exactly where we're headed. And so I think there's a small category of folks like yourself, and I put Chris Hedges and Glenn Greenwald and Henry Giroux and some of those other amazing people in that category, because you just zero right in on the problem. I regularly follow Chris Hedges as well, because I think both of you, the way that you write and again zero in on what exactly the problem is and kind of dismantle the rhetoric that we're hearing through the other mass media, I think you do such an excellent job of that. And so it's just a thrill to be able to talk to you. But
Heidi, let me just say thanks, and I'm honored to
welcome.
Be in that company. I really am.
So go ahead if you have a question or comment, Heidi.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to... So there's a piece by Chris Hedges called The Folly of Empire that I pulled up on Chizdig. And one of the things that he talks about is that there is definitely a culture of the culture of literacy is on the decline, and that we're in basically in the folly of empire. We're seeing the last stages of the United States Empire starting to fall. So they're, you know, resorting to more fascist techniques. And so I guess what I would be interested to hear you say, one of the things that Chris Hedges mentions is that if people really had any idea what is happening to us, they would have turned in fear against Barack Obama, whose signature legacy will be utter capitulation to the vans of Wall Street, the fossil fuel industry, the military-industrial complex, and the security and surveillance state. And so I guess what I want to hear you maybe expand on is that idea in the ways that we think that we have democracy, but in fact that we don't. And you know, the White House is all a party to that. So I'd be interested to hear what you say. So thank you very much for being on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Heidi.
Yeah,
Should I try on that, Paul? I don't know what I can really add to what Heidi has said in this. One word, and this goes back to Barrington Moore, who was just such a fine teacher, and his book is called Social Origins of Dictatorship and Democracy. It came out in 66, and he deals with all the principal forms of political structure, political society, and instead of Germany, he takes Japan as his subtitle for the Japan section is Asian Fascism. And it goes back to what someone else he quotes, a Japanese political scientist, called co-partnership, again, interpenetration, again, business and government together. Now, in terms of what Heidi just said, the thought that did come to mind, and it doesn't go directly to what she's saying, but it's important, is this. There seems to really be a sense of decline or decay, and that, for me, and if Heidi can check this, go back in the archives of Counterpunch, Arno Mayer, who is a very great historian, goes into this point, and that is that when societies are in that process of decay, they start getting desperate, and they do everything possible to head it off. In the case of the United States, which enjoyed unilateral dominant supremacy from, say, the end of World War II, when everyone else was prostrate, and so on, and just kept, come hell or high water, kept that superior position until what I've been calling lately this really important change, this multipolar world, where we see not only Russia and China beginning to provide for a decentering of the world structure, but then third world countries that are industrializing, Brazil, which is now getting stronger, and so on, and the EU acting collectively, not necessarily all of this for the good, but at least eroding American supremacy. So what we're seeing then, I think, is this kind of desperation, which takes the form not only of increased militarism and militarization of policy and so on, but I don't know if Chris Hedges was saying, I sort of got this from Heidi, that maybe this kind of decline of intellectual culture and reading and so on, whether this is actually part of a manipulative framework, or is actually, it seems to me, more a reflection of the whole developmental process where the various things plug in. I think it was Bill who said consumerism or one of the, and so on. All of these things eroding that whole idea of critical thought and critical sensibility and being able to question. And what Glenn Greenwald has said in the final chapter of No Place to Hide is the importance of massive surveillance is not that you're going to uncover terrorism. It's that you're going to scare your own people. You're going to make them look over their shoulder. You're going to make them watch what they're saying. This is one reason I was excited by Kay Boo, in that you guys and gals are really talking serious things. And that's not happening. Try All Things Considered on PBS, and you'll see pretty much an administration line. So that whether or not there's a decline in intellectual culture and in reading, which there seems to be anyway, there seems also to be a real intensification of promoting dumbness. And that dumbness is almost, whether it's to sell more products or whether it's simply to keep in the good graces of an administration where you want to have access to its spokespeople and so on, but you don't dare try really systematic, careful, critical analysis, and instead you ride with it, and it all, you know, and so it seems to be almost like a closed circle, where the intellectual decline, the absence of really strong criticism, become green lights for the execution of policy that becomes bolder and bolder, but dressed up in phonier and phonier language.
Well, it looks like we got one more caller. John, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. I'd like to make an environmental comment on it. I just heard recently, yesterday, on KBOO, that Vermont's passing of the GMO Act is being, prosecuted by Monsanto. And so this fits the whole scenario of, you know, industry and government going together. Anything that happens, even on the food market or environmental market, you get squashed. Also, I'd like to make a comment. Michigan really produces a lot of really great people. Tom Hartman, you know, he's a neighbor of yours, he used to be.
Anyway. Okay.
Yeah, but anyway, I was just commenting anything that, like Dr. Hansen talking about the XL pipeline contributing to the CO2 levels. Well, what they do, Obama says, let it go. So that's all I'm looking at, is an environmental thing that anytime somebody tries to stand up, even though your life depends on it or whatever, everybody's life, it just, you know, industry, you know, they win all the time. That's all my comment is.
Well, I'd like to respond to that, is that, you know, there's a really interesting body of critique that is not really new or unique, but I think really brings a different angle of really looking at this, which is the community rights perspective. I don't know if you're familiar with that, Norman. Thomas Lindsay, out of Pennsylvania, basically says the same thing about the regulatory framework as you do, which basically that it was set up to protect business rather than to protect the environment, workers, health, and all that. I mean, there is some of that, obviously, or it wouldn't function. But if you look at the accumulative effect of the damage on people's health, on the environment, on workers' rights and workers' safety, you see that there's been a continual erosion across the board. And he basically says that that's how the regulatory framework was set in place, and the way that we've been fighting it, whether it's through labor activism or environmental activism, has been ineffective because it doesn't get at the root structure, which is the corporate power as enshrined in the Constitution and the whole structure of law that has been structure of law and legislation, of judicial precedents and legislation that has developed since then, which has protected corporate interests, whether it's the corporate personhood, corporate rights, whatever. So it's basically analyzing this entire structure and basically saying that we really need, and Monsanto's efforts to knock down local laws or state laws is the same as corporations all across the board are trying to take on these local initiatives to rein in the power of corporations.
Right. Thank you, Paul. Because again, and to your person who called, I'm sorry, I just lost his name for a second. But I've been weak in my own thinking and preparation on the environment, only because I think in part it seems so much an expansion of already existing corporate power. And when I think of Obama and I think of Keystone and when I think of Hillary as Secretary of State who jumps in and gets the supervisory role here because there's a crossing of an international boundary, and then gives the environmental impact study to a firm that uses the Canadian outfit as one of its boasts that it's one of its most prominent clients. I mean, the worst conflict of interest you could imagine. Obama is such a loser from my standpoint of on this, but I think a fine point that I would like to make that probably others will disagree with is that he is not a creature of the corporations or a puppet or the like. That might follow anyway and be part of the territory of being the U.S. president and so on. I think he believes much of this. I think that early campaign stuff was so much baloney to get elected, and that Or at least he changed so drastically once, almost from the very beginning. You look at the appointments. You look at Larry Summers. You look at Tim Geithner. You look at all of these people who were part of the Clinton crowd, which brought about the end of the banking. I'm starting to lose my mind here. But the banking regulation and forced, with Robert Rubin, forced the deregulation across the board. It's so clear that Obama is sympathetically vibrating one-on-one with these bank and corporate executives. And so the environment is clearly going to take the hit as unfortunately, very unfortunately, being vulnerable to that kind of depredation and that kind of source of profit-making.
So well, it looks like, Norman, we're running out of time, and unfortunately we're not going to be able to get our last caller in. Apologize to you for that. Hopefully next time.
I apologize to them.
I really appreciate your taking the time. We really didn't get too much into the second part of the question. If this is indeed a fascist society we're living in, well, what then? We'll probably get into that at a later date. Once again, Norman Pollack, thank you for talking with us this morning.
And thanks so much, Paul. And quickly, if you can say hi to Rick Wolf, who's coming on next. We knew each other in Cambridge and have been in email contact. So
I think he's on tape, actually. But
okay, all right. So we'll see you then. Thank you so much for having me, Paul. Okay. And thanks to everybody who called. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And thanks, everybody, for listening. You're listening to KBOO, Portland.
Tragedies, I know. But consider the entertainment value contained within. To remind you, it is you, the people, who have mandated this course of our fate. So please come with me.
Wednesdays for an afternoon of jazz. Hosts of Jazz Lives, A Jazz World, and Jazz in the Afternoon play the very best in jazz music. From the historical to the present, and jazz of all stripes. Swinging, smoking, bluesy, funky, new and old, but all good. That's Wednesday afternoons from noon to 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Saturday, June 28th, for a live broadcast from Good in the Hood. KBOO will broadcast the entertainment from Lilith's Albina Park from 2 to 7 p.m. Tune in to hear what's good in the hood Saturday, June 28th, from 2 to 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.